You're listening to The Read Out. One development leader, their big idea, and how it can shape the future of Australian development assistance. Hosted by Lab CEO, Bridie Rice.
2024 is set to be a huge year for democracy. The majority of the world's population across at least 40 different countries are heading to the national polls this year. And in February, this includes the voters of one of the world's biggest democracies, Indonesia. As the curtains are closing on Jokowi's reign, some are buoyant about the prospects of Indonesia in the coming decade. But others, like my guest today, are worried that the next leader is inheriting a state marked by democratic regression, particularly when it comes to the role of the Indonesian military in the civilian government. Now, to make sense of this, I'm joined today by Natalie Sambi, non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution and leading analyst of all things strategy, security, and Indonesia. Now, the analysis that sparked this conversation, it's an oldie, but it is a goodie. In January 2021, Natalie published a commentary on the Brookings website, and it was called Generals Gaining Ground, Civil-Military Relations and Democracy in Indonesia. Now, I'm keen to hear from Natalie how her thoughts have developed and what this means for Australia's development assistance and support for pluralism in Indonesia. Natalie, it's great to have you here on The Readout.
Good morning, Bridie.
Well, Natalie, look, it was a couple of years ago, I know, when you were putting pen to paper, but what urged you to write on this topic and why is this mattering to Australia?
I mean, I think it goes to the heart of really why I love this topic in the first place. Understanding the Indonesian military is really an essential part of understanding not only Indonesia's past, but its present day as well. And so it's only natural to look at, well, what is the military doing these days? Where does it have influence and how does it affect the country? So, you know, in addition to being an important security actor, the Indonesian military, which may not be known to many of our listeners, has played this influential role in politics in the past and has been, unlike in Australia, a very important social institution in the country as well. And so bringing light onto this topic is important because the way the Indonesian military works is completely different to the way the Australian military works in aspects of politics, social aspects, and economics as well. So just trying to bring some deeper understanding to what those differences are and what they mean for the country.
And Natalie, I thought that your article did a really good job at explaining the key drivers of the military's expanding role in the Indonesian government. You talk a lot about the leadership style of the president, the need to appease military power brokers, as well as tensions with China and the South China Sea. So there's quite a lot to unpick here. Can you talk our listeners through what does this military's expanded role in civilian government mean for Indonesia's next government?
Yeah, so well, if we think about the next government, there are a whole bunch of things when we think about the military and why an expanding role in civilian affairs is really important. One is about accountability and human rights and corruption. Another is about civilian control over budgets and procurement. Another one is about the partisanship of the military rather than neutrality. So all those things need to be in our mind. But before we get to that, I think we need to take a bit of a step back for our listeners and say, okay, a bit of background. Just so you know, since the history of Indonesia's independence, the military has had this important pervasive role. And there was this policy called Dwi Fungsi, called dual function, which legitimated the Indonesian military's role in politics, they had seats in the parliament, in economics, foreign policy, intelligence, and then social aspects as well. So that's the real pedigree of the Indonesian military. That's baked into its DNA. And when President Suharto stepped down in 1998, there was a reform process, but I and several other scholars would argue that that was an incomplete reform process. So what you have today is a military that is a professional military, a largely security actor, but still has in its mindset, in its DNA, this idea that it plays these extra security roles, these roles outside of security, that is. And that is also understood by the political leaders and society that this is just what their military does. This is what their military has always done. And so what we've found in recent years, while the military has that security role, it has to deal with the South China Sea. It has to deal with internal unrest in places like the Papua provinces, and that's a whole separate discussion as well. But it is also increasingly going back to doing a lot of those civilian tasks. And those tasks may include being asked by the president to do things like distribute rice, to build schools, to teach in schools, to, during the pandemic, to hand out COVID vaccines and things like that. But it, more concerningly, is this idea that the military is trying to also regain more influence in internal security. So that sets up a really unhealthy rivalry with the police. And so you have all of these different dynamics going on. And in addition to that, the Indonesian military, for a large chunk of the 20th century, was involved in a lot of human rights violations. And not many of those human rights violations were dealt with once Indonesia democratized. And so holding military personnel who have committed those human rights violations accountable is a really important part of a democratic process as well. So if those things are left incomplete, if those things are left untouched, then you can say the military has had this special place within society, and that influence will be left to augment, and some of those darker, less professional aspects of the military will be left untested and unchecked as well.
I mean, just like the way that you're speaking right now, your article is also quite nuanced on this front. So you're saying on the one hand, you and other scholars are pointing to clear evidence of what you call a democratic backslide in Indonesia, but you're also acknowledging, just as you are right now, that the rule of the military in Indonesia is also very popular. And in your article, you cite a 2020 poll where a whopping 70% of respondents were satisfied with the military's role in government. So if we're accepting these numbers and the nuanced picture that you're facing, what does this public support, but also concern for the military in Indonesian democracy mean for countries like Australia that is working on development assistance and democratic assistance to Indonesia?
It's really interesting, though, because if you look at polls worldwide, a large number of them would show that societies do trust their militaries. Time after time, and particularly in Indonesia, the military is the most trusted institution in spite of these human rights violations, in spite of the pervasive role that it played in repressive policies as well. And there are many reasons for that. But I think the really important thing to remember is that while you might have trust in the military, it's really important that any society has trust in the parliament, in the courts, in oversight mechanisms like the Corruption Eradication Commission and the police. Why? Because those are the civilian institutions that keep check in the military. So while it's important to understand in Indonesia, people see the military as a respected institution, the military does provide social services to them. At the same time, it's really important that the parliament has that trust, and we don't see that in Indonesia. Unfortunately, the parliament and the police are among some of the least trusted institutions. So there's a bit of an imbalance there in terms of those democratic institutions. So again, when we think about development assistance to Indonesia, it's making sure that those democratic institutions are strengthened, and particularly the role of the media. Like a lot of the way in which the military conducts itself would not be necessarily made public or held to account, but for the role of the media. So making sure that those media voices can flourish in present-day Indonesia is really important. Now, I will point out it's really a tough sort of thing to say. At the same time, yes, Indonesia's democracy is having sort of illiberal moments as well. And having a military that is not involved in civilian affairs is not necessarily desirable. The military should stay in its domain. Having said that, the reality of Indonesia's circumstances are complex, that in remote areas of the archipelago, it's not always possible for the state or civilian agencies to get out there. A military, if you think of the ADF, for instance, it's a huge logistics chain and its presence throughout remote parts of the country, just like in Indonesia, it's able to provide services when there are cases of an emergency. And particularly for a country like Indonesia, which is vulnerable to natural disaster and humanitarian pressures, particularly in increasing area of climate change, the military is there to provide that first responder role. It then has constant contact with the people. The people see it and think, you know, thank God the military is there. And so understanding that even if the military's role outside of security issues is not necessarily desirable in a strict civil-military relations paradigm, in many countries in our region, in Southeast Asia, in the Pacific, the military will be playing that role. And that is something for Australian agencies to remember. And understanding where that influence and which effective actors they need to engage with is part of that bigger picture of engaging with our partners in the region. And so, again, that's one hand. And then the other is creating conversations in the Indo-Pacific with our partners about the effectiveness of democratic civilian control over militaries and the division of labor between civilian agencies and security forces. So that's important because it's not just something that we talk to partners about what's going on in their country, but something we reflect on for ourselves as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Natalie, it feels as though we could fill up a couple of hours with this conversation, and I'm sure that our listeners feel the same way. But I am going to put you in the hot seat now. So if you followed the last season of The Readout, you'll know that it's now time to tackle our lab hypothetical. So, Natalie, all of your academic thinking aside, I need you to now imagine a situation where you board an elevator and you find yourself sandwiched between the Australian Foreign Minister and the Minister for International Development. And on either side of them is the team of bureaucrats who are charged with charting the course of Australia's support to Indonesia in the coming 5 to 10 years. Now, you've only got a minute before you all reach your destination and the doors open. So what is the one key thing that they must bear in mind when it comes to Australia's support of democracy in Indonesia in the coming decade?
I'd say, Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, you've done a really good job with engaging Southeast Asia and Indonesia since you've come to office. Let's go a bit further. Let's deepen our broader understanding of the country. Let us help you do that. What do you need to know? You need to know that the Indonesian military, from my perspective, will continue to be an important actor, particularly with a new president coming on board. In order to do that, you need to understand some of the power dynamics, so understanding the civil-military relations in Indonesia. If you want to do that as well, make sure that you come with a really grounded understanding of the civil-military relations balance in our own country and understanding how we are protecting our own democratic institutions before we have those conversations with our counterparts in Jakarta. And in particular, what do we want to work on? Let's work on freedom of the press, human rights protection, free and fair elections, and democratic civilian control of security forces, because all of those things will create a stable, prosperous, and peaceful Indo-Pacific for us and everyone else.
Well, Natalie, I love it when our analysts step out of their ivory towers and actually put policy actions down on paper. You have not disappointed. So, Natalie, thank you for this conversation. You have left us with plenty to mull over.
Thanks, Bridie. Thanks for your interest in Indonesia and civil-military relations.
Well, join me next time on The Readout, where each episode we sit down with one development leader, one big idea, and talk about how it can shape the future of Australia's development assistance. If you liked hearing from Natalie, then you can find a link to her article in our show notes. And stay tuned for the Pulse Check, which will be released by the lab in the coming months. If you want extra previews, insights, and development analysis, then sign up to our email at devintelligencelab.com. And finally, a special thanks to the lab team behind the scenes, Ruby St. Ledger and Walter Kolnagi. Music by Viljami Meto. I'm Bridie Rice. This is The Readout. Talk soon.
We at the lab acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast is recorded, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and we extend our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We're inspired by the storytelling tradition of the world's oldest living culture, and we pay homage to it when we share our stories or intelligence on this podcast.